feel that something is wrong, it is because something is wrong. "Open the lantern gate," I shout, readying myself to turn the horse and spur her away if we are attacked. "Open the lantern gate for the Duchess of Bedford." Slowly, the small door in the great gate creaks open, and a stable lad peers nervously out. "The Duchess of Bedford?" I pull down my hood so he can see my face. "Myself. Where is everybody?" His pinched white face looks up at me. "Run away," he says. "Everyone but me. And I couldn't go because my dog is sick, and I didn't want to leave him. Had I better come with you?" "Run where?" He shrugs. "Run away from Captain Mortimer and his army. Some of them ran to join him, some of them ran away." I shake my head. I cannot understand this. "Where is the king and the queen?" "Run away too," he says. "God's sake, where are they, boy?" "Run away to Kenilworth," he whispers. "But I was told to tell no one." I grip onto my horse's mane with cold hands as my heart thuds. "What? They've abandoned the city?" "They sent out an army to chase Mortimer back to Kent, but Mortimer turned on them and beat them good. The royal commanders were all killed. The army ran back to London, except for those that joined Mortimer. Half of them joined Mortimer. I wish I had gone."
"Who were the commanders that were killed?" I ask quietly. My voice is steady, and I'm pleased at that.
"All the king's lords, I don't know, Lord Northumberland, Baron Rivers."
"They are dead? All of them?"
"They didn't come back, at any rate."
"The king?"
"The king wouldn't go to war," he says contemptuously. "He went out with his standard, but he wouldn't go to war. He kept half his army back and sent out the lords with the other half. And when what was left of them came running back and said they'd lost, he and the Queen ran off to Kenilworth, the Duke of Somerset, Edmund Beaufort, with them. And Lord Scales went to the Tower."
"Is Scales there now? Has he fortified the Tower?" He shrugs.
"I don't know. What's going to happen to me?" he asks.
I look at him, my face as blank as his own. "I don't know. You'd better look out for yourself." I turn my horse from the stable gate of Westminster, since there's no safety there for either of us. I think I'd better get to the Tower before nightfall. She steps out bravely enough, but we're both weary. On every street corner there is a brazier and someone roasting meat, and men drinking ale and swearing that the good times have come, and that Mortimer will advise the king, and there will be no more taxation, and no more cheating of the poor, and the bad advisers will be driven away. They call me to join them, and they curse me when I shake my head. In the end I have to throw a coin and wish them well, and for the last few streets I pull my hood over my face, and sit low in the saddle, and hope to sidle by, like a thief in my own city. I get to the gate of the Tower at last. There are sentries on every wall, and they shout down at me as soon as they see me.
"Halt! Who's there? Stand where you are!"
"The Duchess of Bedford," I call back, showing them my face. "Let me in."
"Your husband, the Baron, has been searching for you all evening,"
the young guardsman says as he throws open the gate, comes out to take my bridle, and helps me down from the horse.
"Your men came in and said they'd lost you. He was afraid you'd been captured by the mob. He said he would see them swing for treason if so much of a hair of your head was hurt. He told them. I've never heard such language."
"My husband?" I ask, suddenly dizzy with hope. "Did you say my husband was looking for me?"
"Like a madman."
He starts, then he turns to listen, and we both hear the clatter of hooves on the cobbles. He shouts,
"Horses! Close the gate!"
and we rush inside as the gates creak behind us. Then I hear Richard shout,
"Rivers! Open up!"
And they fling open the double gates, and his little band of men rides in like thunder, and he sees me in a moment and jumps down from his horse and catches me up in his arms and kisses me as if we were a squire and his lady once more, and couldn't bear to part. "Dear God, I have ridden all round London looking for you," he gasps. "I was so afraid they'd taken you. Cutler at the house said you were going to Westminster, and the boy at Westminster knew nothing." I shake my head, tears running down my face, laughing at the sight of him. "I'm safe, I'm safe. I got caught up in the crowd and separated from our men. Richard, I thought you were dead. I thought you'd been killed in an ambush in Kent." "Not I. Poor Stafford was killed, and his brother, but not I. Are you safe? Do you feel well? How did you get here?" "I got swept up in the crowd. I saw him enter London."
"Jack Cade?"
"The captain? He's John Mortimer."
"Jack Cade is his name, but he's calling himself Mortimer, and John Amend All, and all sorts of names. The name Mortimer brings out the supporters of Richard of York for him. It's York's family name. Cade is borrowing it, or worse, the Duke is lending it. Either way, it means more trouble. Where did you see him?"
"Crossing the bridge, and getting the keys of the city."
"Getting the keys?"
my husband demands, dumbfounded. "They greeted him as a hero, all the common people, and the mayor, and the alderman too. He was dressed like a nobleman coming to rule."
He lets out a whistle. "God save the king. You'd better tell Lord Scales. He's in command here."
He tucks his hand under my elbow and leads me to the White Tower.
"Are you tired, beloved?"
"A little."
"And you feel well? The baby?"
"All right, I think. All well."
"Were you frightened?"
"A little." "My love, I thought you were dead."
"Not I."
I hesitate. "Have you seen our house?"
"Nothing that we can't repair when this is over."
I glance at him. "They walked in through the door and took what they wanted. It will be hard to repair that." He nods.
"I know, but we will do it. Now, I'll get you some wine and some meat as soon as we find Scales. He'll need to know where Cade is tonight."
"Dining with the Lord Mayor, I think."
Richard pauses and looks at me. "A man who has brought an army out of Kent and defeated the King's men has the keys to the city of London and is dining with the Lord Mayor?"
I nod. "They greeted him like he was freeing them from a tyrant. The Lord Mayor and all the aldermen welcomed him to the city like a hero."
Richard scowls. "You'd better tell Scales," is all he says.
Lord Scales is in a state of ill-concealed terror. He is using the constable of the Tower's house, and he has double guards on the front and back doors and at the windows. Clearly, he fears that his king has abandoned him and the city together to the men from Kent. His men may be of royal guard and have taken the king's shilling, but what is to say they are not Kentish men, or that they don't have a family making a poor living at Dover? Half of them have come from Normandy and feel betrayed. Why should they defend us now, who let them be driven from their own homes? When I tell him that Cade was welcomed as a hero, he tells me that I must have been mistaken.
"He's a scoundrel and a villain," he rules.
"There were many in his train who were gentlemen," I say. "I could see they had good horses and good saddles. Cade himself rode like a man accustomed to command. And there was only one alderman in the whole of the city who didn't welcome him."
"He's a villain," he says rudely.
I raise an eyebrow at Richard. He shrugs as if to say that I have done my best to give this most nervous commander an idea of the enemy, and if he is too afraid to listen, then I need do no more. I'll take my wife to my rooms and get her something to eat, he says to Lord Scales. Then shall I come back and we can plan an attack? Perhaps tonight when they've wined and dined, while they're celebrating, or as they march back to Southwark. We could catch them in the narrow streets before the bridge and push them over. Not tonight. Not tonight, Scales says quickly. Besides, I'm expecting reinforcements from the King. He will send us men from the Midlands. They can't come for days, if they come at all, my husband says. Surely we should attack them now, before they expect it, while they're drinking. Not tonight, Scales repeats. These are not Frenchmen, Rivers. Our experience is no use here. These are treasonous peasants. They fight around back streets and in hiding. We should wait till we have a great force to overwhelm them. I will send another message to the King and ask for his command.
I see my husband hesitate, and then he decides not to argue. He throws his cape around my shoulders and takes me to his lodgings. We have our usual rooms near the royal apartments in the tower, but it feels strange with the King and Queen so far away, and the drawbridge up, and the portcullis down, and us besieged among the people who are our countrymen.
It's damnable, my husband says shortly, snapping his fingers for the serving man to leave the tray of food. Damnable. And the very men who should be putting down this unrest are either too half-hearted or too afraid to act. Get you to bed, sweetheart, and I will join you after I've posted a watch. That we should be all but besieged, in the Tower of London, at war, in England, with Englishmen, it beggars belief.
We live under siege in the Tower, at war in our own country, besieged in our own capital city. Every day my husband sends out men, and even the kitchen girls, to get news in the marketplace and at the city gates. They come back saying that Cade's army is camped south of the river, with more joining them every day. Richard's great fear is that the uprising will spread, and the men of Hampshire and Sussex will join the men of Kent. What about our home? I ask him, thinking of the children in their nursery. Should I go back to them?
The roads aren't safe, he says, scowling with worry. I'll send you with a guard as soon as I know what's happening. But I don't even know if the King is safely at Kenilworth. We have sent messages, but have heard nothing back yet. If he's besieged... He breaks off.
It feels like the end of the world. If the common people rise against the King, if they are armed with weapons they have won from us, if they are commanded by a man who has been trained by us and embittered by losses in France, then there is no hope that the world we know can continue. Only a heroic king who could capture the love of the people could save us, and we have only King Henry hiding at Kenilworth, his beautiful armour laid aside after its one and only outing. A message comes from the rebel army. They want Lord Say, the man who was Lord of Kent, sent out for trial.
We cannot release him to them, my husband says to the commander, Lord Scales. They will kill him. We're holding him here under arrest for treason, the Lord says reasonably enough. He could well have been tried and found guilty, and then he would have been executed anyway. The King sent him here for his safety, not to charge him with treason, as we both know, my lord. The King would have released him. You know the King would have forgiven him anything he has done. I shall release him to them, and if he's innocent of all they say, then he can tell them so, Lord Scales says. My husband swears under his breath, and then speaks clearly. My lord, if we send Lord Say out to them, guilty or innocent, they will kill him. This is not a release. It is to push him out of safety to his death,
If this doesn't matter to you now, then I ask what you will do if the rebels ask for me to be sent out to them. What would you like us to do when they ask for you? His lordship glowers. I wasn't the man who said I would make a deer park out of Kent. I didn't say they were too good for hanging and should be pushed into the sea. You are adviser to the king, as are we all. They could name any one of us and ask for us to be sent out. Are we going to obey the servants? Are they our new masters? Lord Scales rises from his seat behind the great dark wooden table and goes to the arrow-slit window that looks towards the city. Woodville, my old friend, I know you are right, but if they attack us with the numbers they have now, they are likely to take the tower. And then we will all be at their mercy, your wife as well as us. We can hold out, my husband says. They have a full-size army at Southwark, and every day more men come from Essex and camp out there. There are hundreds now. Who knows how strong they may become? If they come from Essex, what's to stop them coming from Hertfordshire, from Nottinghamshire? What if they can raise the whole country against us? Better strike now, before they grow any stronger. What if they have the king and we don't yet know it? Then we will have to fight them. But if we negotiate with them, promise them a pardon, say that their grievances will be resolved, promise them an inquiry, they will go back to their little farms and get the hay in. If we pardon them, we will have taught them that they can take up arms against the King of England. My husband objects. And that is a lesson we may regret one day. I cannot risk the safety of the tower, Lord Scales says firmly. We cannot attack. We must prepare to defend. At the worst, Lord Say buys us time. There is a silence as my husband absorbs the fact that they are going to send one of the peers of England out to face a mob that wants him dead. You are the commander, he says stiffly. I am here under your command. But my advice is that we defy them. That afternoon, they send Lord Say out to Guildhall, where these aldermen who have the stomach for it, and the rebels who are eager for it, create a little court for the day. They persuade his lordship to confess, find him a priest, and take him to Cheapside for execution. His son-in-law, the Sheriff of Kent, William Cromer, thinks himself lucky to be released from the Fleet prison, and steps out of the stone doorway cheerfully, thinking a rescue party has come for him, only to find a scaffold waiting for him outside the gates. They don't even bother to try him, but string him up without ceremony. God forgive them, my husband says, as we stand on the walls of the tower, hidden by the parapet, looking down into the streets below. A dancing, singing, chanting mob is weaving its unsteady way through the narrow lanes towards the tower. My husband interposes his broad shoulder before me, but I peep around his arm and see what is leading the procession. They have the head of Lord Say on a pike, bobbing along at the front of the crowd. Behind, on another pike, is the stabbed head of William Cromer, the sheriff who promised to lay waste to his county of Kent. As they come within range of the tower gates, they pause and bawl defiance, and then dance the two heads together. The dead faces bump. The pike-bearers jiggle the pikes so the mouths knock one against another. They're kissing! They're kissing! They howl and roar with laughter at the spectacle. Send us out, Lord Scales! They bellow. He can have a kiss, too. Richard draws me back into the shadow of the wall. My God, I say quietly. This is the end, isn't it? This is the end of the England we have known. This is the end of everything. Next night, at dinner, I see Richard put his head down over his plate and eat steadily,
hardly pausing for breath, but drinking no wine at all. Throughout the meal, his servants come and whisper brief messages in his ear. After dinner, there is never dancing or singing, not even playing at cards. But tonight, it is even more hushed and nervous. The remnants of this beleaguered court stand around in groups and exchange fearful whispers. Then Richard stands up on the steps of the dais and raises his voice.
My lords, gentlemen, a number of the gentlemen and merchants of London tell me that they are weary of Cade and his men running riot through the city. Also, matters are getting worse, and no man can be sure that his home and his goods are safe. Cade has lost control of his men, and they are looting the city. The London men tell me that they are determined to push the soldiers out of the city, back to their camp at Southwark tonight, and I have agreed that we will join with them to drive the rebels back, raise the drawbridge, and close the gate. They are not going to enter London again.
He raises his hand at the buzz of noise.
Lord Scales will command, he says. We will muster in the courtyard at 9 o'clock. Weapons will be distributed now. I expect all able-bodied men to arm and come with me.
He steps down, and men crowd around him at once. I hear him explaining the plan and sending men to get their weapons. I stand a little closer and wait for him to turn to me.
I'll leave a guard on the tower. Enough to hold it. The king is sending reinforcements from the Midlands. They will be here tomorrow or the next day. You'll be safe here until I come back.
He sees the unspoken question in my face.
If I don't come back, you should put on your plainest clothes and make your way on foot out of the city, he says. Cutler will go with you, or any of our men. Once you're out of the city, you can buy or borrow horses to get home. I can't tell what will happen then, but if you can get home to the children, you can live off our lands, and you should be safe there until it all comes right again. Our tenants would stand by you. Jaketa, I'm sorry. I never thought it would come to this. I didn't mean to bring you out of France to danger in England.
Because if the rebels take London, then nowhere is safe, I ask him. If you cannot drive them out of the city, then they will take England in time.
I don't know how this will end, he says. A king who leaves London to the peasants and a half-paid captain? A penniless crowd who say that they own the city? I don't know what might happen next.
Come back is all I can manage.
It is my intention, he says tightly. You are the love of my life. I will come back to you if I possibly can. I have sworn it. I'm going to be there at the baptism of our new baby, my love. And God willing, make another. A vision of the dancing head of Lord Say comes to my mind, and I blink to try to rid myself of it.
Richard, God send you back safely to me, I whisper. I watch them muster in the great central yard of the tower, and then leave quietly by the sally port into the silent streets. I climb to the walkway at the top of the walls that run around the tower, and stand by a soldier on guard to watch them make their way quietly to the city. Richard has them in squares, 4 men by 4 men, all of them with pikes, many with swords, most of them with muffled feet. I see all this, but I'm trying to see more. I'm trying to see if there's a shadow over them, if they are marching out to their death. Especially, I am looking for the tall figure of my husband, at the head of his division, his sword drawn, his hooded head looking this way and the other, every sense alert, vibrantly alive, angry to have been brought to this. I glimpse him only briefly before they slip between the crowded buildings, but I have no sense of premonition. Richard seems, as he always has been, so passionately alive, so vital,
that there could never be a shadow over him. For a moment I think that perhaps this proves that he will come home in the morning in triumph. And then I think that if he were going out to certain death, he would still go out to it with his head up, his shoulders squared, and his footstep light. Then we wait. We can hear some shouting from the street, and we have the cannon trained on the raggle-taggle army camped in the marshes below the tower, and pointed north to the street. But no one comes within range. The fighting is going on hand to hand, in one street after another, as the rebels surge forwards, and the apprentices and merchants, well-armed and defending their homes, push them back. My husband commanding one wing of our forces, and Lord Scales commanding another, fight their way through the treacherous streets, always heading for the river. The rebels make a stand before Bridgegate, where the lanes grow close and narrow, but the soldiers from the tower push forwards and push on, and gradually they yield, falling back over the bridge, a yard at a time. This time the doors of the houses on the bridge are barred, and the shutters are over the windows. The tradesmen and merchants on the bridge are battened inside their homes, sick of the disorder and fearing worse, as the slow battle grinds across the river, a yard at a time. The grinning heads of Lord Say and William Cromer look down from the spikes of the bridge as their murderers are pressed back, one slow pace after another, and the royal army doggedly pushes on. Forewarned by me, my husband has thick coils of rope and craftsmen in the vanguard of the men, and as soon as they force their way past the anchor point, he has the workmen ringed with a guard as they feverishly replace the ropes that I saw Jack Cade slash with his stolen sword. Desperately the men work, fearing arrows and missiles from the rebel army, as my husband at the head of his men fights with his sword in one hand and an axe in the other, going forwards and forwards until Cade's army is thrust to the far side of the bridge. Then, at a shouted command from my husband, and a blast of trumpets loud above the noise, the royal army breaks off, runs back to its own side, and with a rumble and a roar the drawbridge is raised, and my husband leans on his bloody sword, grins at Lord Scales, and then looks back along the long 20-span bridge at the English dead who are being rolled carelessly into the river, and the wounded who are groaning and calling for help. That night, he sits in a deep hot bath in our rooms, and I soak the nape of his neck and his strong muscled back, as if we were a peasant and his doxy taking their annual bath on Shrove Tuesday.
"Good," he says. "Pray God the worst of this is over."
"Will they beg for forgiveness?"
"The king has sent pardons already," he says, his eyes closed as I pour a jug of hot water over his head. "Hundreds of them. Blank forms of pardons. Hundreds of them without a thought. And a bishop to fill in the names. They are all to be forgiven and told to go home."
"Just like that?" I ask.
"Just like that," he says.
"Do you think they will each take a pardon and go home and forget all about it?"
he says. "But the king hopes that they were misled and mistaken, and that they've learnt their lesson and will accept his rule. He wants to think that this is all the fault of a bad leader, and the rest of them were just mistaken."
"Queen Margaret won't think that," I predict,
knowing the power of her temper, and that she learned how to rule over a peasantry who were held down by force and deference. "No, she won't. But the king has decided on pardons, whatever she thinks." Jack Cade's army, which was so brave and so filled with hope for a better world, lines up to take the pardons, and seems to be glad to do so. Each man says his name, and Bishop William Wainfleet's clerk in the rebel camp with a little writing desk writes each name down and tells each man to go home, that the king has forgiven his offence. The bishop blesses them,
signing the cross over each bowed head, and tells them to go in peace. Jack Cade himself lines up for his piece of paper, and is publicly forgiven for leading an army against the king, killing a noble lord, and invading London. Some men see this as the king's weakness, but the greatest number of them think themselves lucky to get off scot-free, and they go back to their poor homes, where they cannot pay their taxes, where they cannot get justice, where the great lords ride roughshod over them, and hope for better times. They are just as they were before, but more bitter, and still the good times have not come. But not Cade. I find my husband in the stables, his face dark with temper, ordering our horses in a bellowing voice. It seems that we are going back to Grafton. We are going back to Grafton at once. The roads are safe enough if we take a good guard. What's the matter? I ask. Why are we going now? Isn't the king coming? Should we not stay in London?
I can't stand to see him, nor her, he says flatly. I want to go home for a while. We'll come back, of course we will. We'll come back the moment they send for us. But before God, Jacquetta, I cannot stomach the court a moment longer.
Why? What has happened?
He is tying his travelling cape on the back of his saddle, and his back is to me. I go behind him and put my hand on his shoulder. Slowly he turns to face me. I see you're angry, I say. But speak to me. Tell me what has happened.
The pardons, he says through his clenched teeth. Those damned pardons. Those hundreds of pardons.
Yes?
Jack Cade took his pardon in the name of John Mortimer, the name he used in battle.
So?
So they chased after him, despite his pardon, and they have captured him, despite his pardon. They showed them his pardon, signed by the king, blessed by the bishop, written fair in the name of John Mortimer. But they are going to hang him in the name of Jack Cade.
I pause, struggling to understand. The king gave him a pardon. He can't be hanged. He just has to show his pardon. They cannot hang him.
The king's pardon is in one name, which they know him by. They will hang him under another.
I hesitate. Richard, he should never have been pardoned in the first place.
No. But here, we show everyone that his very cause was just. He said that there was no rule of law, but that the lords and the king do as they please. Here we prove it is so. We make a peace on the battlefield while he is in arms, while he is strong and we are weak, when he is near to victory and we are trapped in the tower. We give him a pardon. That is our word of honour. But we break it as soon as he's a fugitive. The king's name is on the pardon. The king gave his word. Turns out, that means nothing. The pardon is worth no more than the paper, the king's own signature, nothing more than ink. There is no agreement. There is no justice. We betray our own cause. We are forsworn.
Richard, he is still our king. Right or wrong, he is still the king.
I know. And that is why I say that we will come back to court and serve him again. He is our king. We are his people. He gave us our name and our fortune. We will come back to court in the autumn. But I swear to you, Jacquetta, I just can't stomach it this summer.
Grafton, Northamptonshire, summer 1450. We arrive at our home at the height of the year, with the harvest coming in and the calves weaned from the cows. In the loft, the apples are laid in rows, strict as soldiers, and one of the tasks for Lewis, now 12,
is to go up every day with a basket and bring down 8 apples for the children to eat after their dinners. I'm feeling weary with this baby, and as the evenings are cool and quiet, I'm happy to sit by the fire in my small chamber and listen while Richard's cousin Louise, who serves as governess to the older ones and nurse to the babies, hears them read from the family Bible. Anthony, at 8, has a passion for books, and will come to me to look at the pictures in the volumes of Latin and old French that I inherited from my husband, and puzzle out the words in the difficult script. I know that this autumn he and his brothers and sisters can no longer be taught by the priest, and I must find a scholar to come and teach them. Lewis especially must learn to read and write in Latin and Greek, if he is to attend the King's College. The baby comes in the middle of August, and we fetch down the family crib, polish it up, launder the little sheets, and I go into my confinement. She is born easily, she comes early, without great trouble, and I call her Martha. Within a few weeks Richard has taken her into the small chapel where we were married, and she is christened, and soon I am churched and up and about again. It is her, the new baby, whom I think of when I start up out of bed one night, as alert as if I'd heard someone suddenly call my name. "What is it?" I demand into the darkness. Richard, groggy from sleep, sits up in the bed. "Beloved, someone called my name. There's something wrong."
"Did you have a bad dream?"
"I thought..." Our lovely old house is silent in the darkness. A beam creaks as the old timbers settle. Richard gets out of bed and lights a taper at the dying fire, and then lights a candle so that he can see me.
"Taketa, you are as white as a ghost."
"I thought someone woke me."
"I'll take a look around," he decides, and pulls on his boots and drags his sword out from under the bed.
"I'll go to the nursery," I say. He lights me a candle, and the two of us go out together into the dark gallery above the hall. And then I hear it, the strong, sweet singing of Melusina, so high and so pure that you would think it was the sound of the stars moving in their spheres. I put my hand on Richard's arm.
"Do you hear that?"
"No.
What?"
"Music," I say.
"I don't want to say her name."
"I thought I heard music." It is so clear and so powerful that I can't believe he can't hear it. Like silver church bells, like the truest choir.
"Who would be playing music at this time of night?"
he starts to ask. But already I've turned to run down the corridor to the nursery. I stop at the door and make myself open it quietly. Martha, the new baby, is asleep in her crib, the nursemaid in the truckle bed nearest to the fire. I put my hand on the child's rosy cheek. She is warm, but not in fever. Her breath comes slowly and steadily, like a little bird breathing in a safe nest. In the high-sided bed beside her sleeps Dickon, humped up with his face buried in the down mattress. Gently, I lift him and turn him on his back, so I can see the curve of his sleeping eyelids and his rosebud mouth. He stirs a little at my touch, but he doesn't wake. The music grows louder, stronger. I turn to the next bed. John, the 5-year-old, is sprawled out in sleep as if he's too hot. The covers kicked sideways, and at once I fear that he is ill. But when I touch his forehead, he's cool. Jaquetta, next to him, sleeps quietly, like the neat little 6-year-old girl she is. Mary, in bed beside her, stirs at the light from my candle, but still sleeps. Their 11-year-old sister Anne is in a truckle bed beside them, fast asleep. Anthony, 8 years old, in the bigger bed, sits up.
"What is it, Mama?"
"Nothing. Nothing," I say. "Go to sleep."
"I heard singing," he says.
"There is no singing," I say firmly. Lie down and close your eyes.
Lewis is really hot,
he remarks, but does as he's told. I go quickly to their bed. The two boys sleep together, and as Anthony turns on his side, I see that Lewis, my darling son, is flushed and burning up. It is his fever that has made their shared bed so hot. As I see him and hear the insistent ringing music, I know that it is Lewis, my darling 12-year-old son, who is dying. The door behind me opens, and Richard, my husband, says quietly, "It's all secure in the house. Are the children well?" "Lewis," is all I can say. I bend to the bed and I lift him. He is limp in my arms. It is like lifting a dead body. Richard takes him from me and leads the way to our bedroom. "What is it?" he asks, laying the boy on our bed. "What's wrong with him? He was well during the day."
"A fever. I don't know," I say helplessly.
"Watch him while I get something for him." "I'll sponge him," he suggests. "He's burning up. I'll try to cool him down."
I nod and go quickly to my still room. I have a jar of dried yarrow leaves, and a bunch of the white blossom hangs from one of the beams. I set a pot on to boil and make a tea from the blossom, and then steep the leaves in a bowl of the boiled water. I'm fumbling in my haste, and all the time the music is ringing in my head, as if to tell me that there's no time, that this is the song of mourning, that all this brewing of tea that smells of summer harvests is too late for Lewis. All I need for him is rosemary. I take the drink in a cup and the soaking leaves in the jar and run back up to the bedroom. On the way, I tap on the door of my lady-in-waiting and call. "Anne, get up. Lewis is sick," and hear her scramble inside. Then I go into our bedroom. Richard has stirred the fire and lit more candles, but he has drawn the bed curtains so Lewis's face is shaded from the light. Lewis has turned away. I can see the rapid breaths as his thin little chest rises and falls. I put the mug and the jar on the table and go to the bedside. "Lewis," I whisper. His eyelids flutter open at the sound of my voice. "I want to go in the water," he says, quite clearly. "No, stay with me." I hardly know what I'm saying. I raise him so his head is against my shoulder, and Richard presses the mug of yarrow tea into my hand. "Take a little sip," I say gently. "Come along. Take a little sip." He turns his head away. "I want to go in the water," he repeats. Richard looks desperately at me. "What does he mean?" "It's a vision from the fever," I say. "It means nothing." I'm afraid of what it means. Lewis smiles, and his eyelids flicker open, and he sees his father. He smiles at him. "I shall swim, father," he says firmly. "I shall swim." And he turns his head and takes a little breath like someone preparing to dive in deep, cool waters, and I feel his body quiver as if with joy, and then go still and quiet, and I realize that my son has gone from me. "Open the window," I say to Richard. Without a word, he turns and opens the window, as if to let the little soul out and up to heaven. Then he comes back and puts the sign of the cross on Lewis's forehead. He's still warm, but he is slowly cooling. I think the sweet waters of his dream are washing him down. Anne taps on the door, opens it, and sees me lay Lewis gently down on the bed. "He's gone," I say to her. "Lewis has gone from us." Hardly knowing what I am doing, I step towards Richard, and he puts his arm around me and holds me close to him. "God bless him," he says quietly. "Amen," I say.
Oh, Richard, I could do nothing. I could do nothing.
I know, he says.
I'll go and see the other children, Anne says into the silence. And then I'll get Mrs. Westbury to come and wash the body. I'll wash him, I say at once. And I'll dress him. I don't want anyone else to touch him. I'll put him... I find I can't say the word, coffin.
I'll help you, Richard says quietly. And we'll bury him in the churchyard, and know that he's just gone ahead of us, Jacquetta. And that one day we will swim in the water too, and find him on the other side.
We bury my son in the churchyard near to his grandfather, and Richard orders a grand stone monument with room for our names too. The rest of the children don't take the fever. Even the new baby, Martha, is well and strong. I watch them, filled with a terror, for a week after we bury Lewis, but none of them so much as sneezes. I think that I will dream of Lewis, but I sleep deeply every night and dream of nothing at all. Until one night, a month after his death, I dream of a river, a deep, cool river, studded with yellow water lilies, flowing over a bed of gold and bronze stones, and golden kingcups growing on the green, reedy banks. I see my boy, Lewis, on the far side of the river, pulling on his linen shirt and his breeches. And he's smiling at me and waving to show that he's going to run on ahead, just a little way ahead. And in my dream, though I want to hold him back, I wave at him and call to him that I will see him later, that I will see him soon, that I will see him in the morning. Our retreat to Grafton lasts only for a little while. In September, the King's Messenger rides down the green lanes and up to our front gates. The wide wooden doors swing open, and he comes across the courtyard, the royal standard before him, a guard of six riding with him. I am walking back from chapel in the morning, and I pause as I see the gate admit him. And I wait, my back to the door of our house, with a sense of danger coming our way. Behind my back, I cross my fingers, as if a childish sign can prevent trouble.
"A message for Baron Rivers," he says, dismounting and bowing.
"I am the Dowager Duchess, Lady Rivers," I say, holding out my hand. "You can give it to me." He hesitates. "My husband is hunting," I continue. "He will be back tomorrow. In his absence, I rule here. You'd better give the message to me."
"I beg your pardon, Your Grace,"
he says, and hands it over. The royal seal is shiny and hard. I break it and look up to nod to him. "You will find ale and bread and meat for you and your men in the hall," I tell him. "And someone will show you where to wash. I will read this and send a reply when you've eaten and rested." He bows again, and the guards give their horses to the stable boys and go into the house. I wait, and then walk slowly to a stone bench let into the wall at the side of the garden, and sit in the warm sunshine to read the letter. It is a letter of appointment, another great honour for us. It is an acknowledgement of Richard's service in the late troubles. It shows that the Lord of the Privy Council were watching to see who was quick of mind and brave of heart and ready to serve them, even if the King and Queen had run away to Kenilworth and saw nothing. It says that Richard is appointed as Seneschal of Gascony, the rich land around Bordeaux that the English have held for 300 years and hope to hold forever. Once again, Richard and I are to be an occupying force in France. Reading through the lines, I guess that the King, shocked by the loss of English lands in Normandy by Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, is inspired to fortify the lands in Gascony with a more experienced commander. This appointment is an honour. It will bring with it the danger and difficulty of strengthening the forces around Bordeaux, holding the lands against French incursions, keeping the people loyal to England, and reversing their sense that they are all but abandoned by a homeland that cannot rule itself, let alone maintain lands overseas. I look up from the letter. It is grief which makes me feel that nothing matters. I know this is a great honour. To rule Gascony is a great command. The rivers are rising, even if one of us is missing. And there is no point in letting my heart ache for the one who is missing. I look at the letter again. In the margin, like a monk illustrating a manuscript, the king is written in his own clerkish hand. Dear Rivers, oblige me by going at once to Plymouth, and mustering and organising a force to take to Gascony, and a fleet to carry them. You should set sail on September 21st, no later. Below this, the Queen has written to me, Jaquetta, lucky you, going back to France. Lucky is not how I feel. I look around the yard, at the warm red brick walls capped with white copping stones that lean against the old chapel, the apple tree bowing low with the weight of the last of the fat fruit ready for picking, the barn which abuts the granary, and our house set plumb in the middle of it all, warm in the sunshine, peaceful this morning, my children at their lessons. I think that the king is setting my husband a task that will likely be impossible, and that once again I have to go to a new country, a new city, and hope to survive among the people who begrudge our very presence. I try to encourage myself by thinking that Gascony will be beautiful in autumn, that perhaps I will be able to see my brothers and sisters, that winter in Bordeaux will be crisp and bright and clear, and that spring will be glorious. But I know that the people of the country will be surly and resentful, the French a constant threat, and we will wait for money from England to pay the soldiers, and end up paying out of our own pocket. While at home there will be endless accusations of failure, and even treason. I will have to leave my children behind in England. I don't want to go, and I don't want Richard to go either. I wait for a long time until the royal messenger comes out into the yard, wiping his mouth on his sleeve, then sees me, sketches a bow, and waits. You can tell His Grace that my husband and I will leave for Plymouth at once, I say. Tell him that we are honoured to serve. He smiles ruefully, as if he knows that the service of this king may be an honour, that it is only a sinecure for the very few favourites who can get away with doing nothing or even fail outright, like Edmund Beaufort, Duke of Somerset, who is now Constable of all England, as a reward for running to Kenilworth when there was dangerous work to do in Kent. God save the king, he says, and goes off to the stable to find his horses. Amen, I respond, thinking that perhaps we should pray that the king is saved from himself. Plymouth, autumn 1450 to 1451. One long year, while we struggle with the burghers of Plymouth, trying to persuade them to house and equip an invasion fleet. One whole year, while my husband assembles a fleet from the privately owned ships of merchants, traders, and the few great lords who keep their own vessels. By midwinter, months after we were supposed to sail, he has more than 80 boats tied up at the quaysides of Plymouth, Dartmouth, and Kingsbridge, and more than 3,000 men, housed in inns and rooms, cottages and farms, all round Devon and Cornwall, waiting. That's all we do. From autumn through winter to spring, we wait. First we wait for the men who have been promised by their lords to march to Plymouth, ready to embark. Richard rides out to meet them and bring them in, finds them quarters, finds them food, promises them wages. Then we wait for the ships that have been requisitioned to come in. Richard rides all around the West Country, buying up little sailing ships in their home ports,
demanding that the greater merchants make their contribution. Then we wait for the stores to arrive. Richard rides to Somerset, even into Dorset, to get grain. Then we wait for the lords who will sail with the invasion to finish the merry days of Christmas and come to Plymouth. Then we wait for the king's command that we should finally set sail. Then we wait for the spring northerlies to die down. And always, 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 we wait for the ship that will bring the money from London so that we can pay the harbourside merchants, the ship owners, the sailors, the men themselves. Always we wait, and the money never comes when it should. Sometimes it comes late, and Richard and I have to send to Grafton and our friends at court to lend us money, so that we can at least feed the army before they march out to the farms around the port and steal to feed themselves. Sometimes it comes, but in such small amounts that we can only pay the outstanding debts and offer the men just a quarter of their pay. Sometimes it comes as tally sticks that we take to the king's custom houses, and they say regretfully, "Yes, it's good, my lord. I grant your right to be paid, but I have no money to pay you with. Come again next month." Sometimes it's promised, and never comes at all. I watch Richard, riding to the little towns of Devon, trying to appease the local landlords, who are furious at having this hungry horde quartered upon them. I watch him pursue roving bands of the men who are supposed to be his army, and are becoming brigands. I watch Richard begging the shipmasters to keep their vessels ready to sail, in case the order for the invasion comes tomorrow, the next day, or the day after. And I watch Richard when the news comes from France that the French king has advanced on Bergerac and Bazas and taken them. In spring, we hear his forces are advancing on English lands on either side of the Gironde. He set siege to Fronsac on the Dordogne, and the townspeople wait behind its great walls, swearing they will not give up, certain that our army is coming to relieve them. Our army is on the quayside, where the ships are bobbing, when we hear that Fronsac has surrendered. The English settlers are appealing for help. They vow that they will fight, that they will resist, that they are Englishmen, and count themselves as Englishmen born and bred. They stake their lives on their faith in us. They swear that their countrymen will come to their aid. I watch Richard trying to hold his army together, trying to hold his fleet together, sending message after message to London, pleading with the court to send him the order to sail. Nothing comes. Richard starts to say that when he gets the order to sail, he will leave me behind. He dare not take me to Bordeaux if the place is going to come under siege. I walk along the protective wall of the harbour and look south to the lands of France that my first husband used to command, and wish that we were both safely home in Grafton. I write to the Queen myself. I tell her that we are ready to go to the rescue of Gascony, that we can do nothing without money to pay the soldiers, and that while they kick their heels in the farms and villages, they complain of their treatment by us, their masters and lords. And the working men and women of Devon see how badly the soldiers and sailors are treated, and say that this is a kingdom where a man is not rewarded for doing his duty. They mutter that the men of Kent had it right, that this is a king who cannot hold his own lands here or abroad, that he is badly advised. They whisper that Jack Cade called for Richard, Duke of York, to be admitted to the king's councils, and that Jack Cade was right, and died for his belief. They even say, though I never tell her this, that she is a French woman squandering the money that should go to the army so that her own country can seize the land of Gascony, and England will be left with nothing in France at all. I beg her to tell her husband to send the order for his fleet to set sail. Nothing comes. In July we hear that Bordeaux has fallen to the French. In September the first refugees from Bayonne start to arrive in tattered craft, and say that the whole of the Duchy of Gascony has been captured by the French, while the expedition to save them, commanded by my unhappy husband, waited in the dock at Plymouth, eating the stores and waiting for orders. We have been living in a little house overlooking the harbour for all of this long year. Richard uses the first floor room as his headquarters.